On this week's 51%, a number of Planned Parenthoods in New York plan to merge. An award-winning broadcast journalist pens a novel.
This is a book about a woman finding her voice at work. So many books I read as a kid were about women finding their voice in a relationship or in their family.
And hear why a woman is leading a different kind of health study. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
She left one night with just a nod. Was lost from some back at a job. I close my eyes and Sally's pigeons fly. She never saw those birds again. And me, I can't remember when.
In New York, five Planned Parenthood affiliates plan to merge into one entity called Planned Parenthood of Greater New York. And the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood New York City would assume leadership of the new entity. In an interview, Laura McQuaid discussed the proposed merger and her new leadership role.
So this is a strategic move that has been in the works, this particular merger, for 2 years. Conversations about what's the right strategic organization in New York State to provide the highest quality care to the most patients has really been under conversation for a number of years. So this is a strategic move, and we are proactively coming together. Again, this is not a crisis merger. All five affiliates are strong financially and have a really solid healthcare footprint. But we really fundamentally believe, given the direction that healthcare is going, that together we can offer more and better, not only to our current patients, but to a significant number of patients that are currently getting care nowhere.
For example, she says the proposed merger would help streamline resources.
The whole idea of coming together was to bring the best of all five organizations and free up dollars that are being duplicative, right, to invest in new services, new locations, you know, improving the patient experience. And also, for example, you know, so say someone lives in Poughkeepsie and goes to NYU for college, right? Currently, they come down, and although we are all Planned Parenthoods, they really kind of have to start over with us, right? They walk through the door, they say, oh, I'm a Planned Parenthood patient in Poughkeepsie, but we still have to treat them as a new patient. All of this will allow us to go on one instance of electronic medical records, which means that that very same patient will come down and go into one of our centers here in New York City and have a seamless experience. No transfer of files, no re-registration.
The five merging affiliates are Planned Parenthood of New York City, Nassau County, Mid-Hudson Valley, Mohawk Hudson, and Southern Finger Lakes. This leaves four affiliates in New York independent, and the new entity will partner with them. Planned Parenthood of Greater New York will include half of New York's counties, covering 65% of the state's population. She says the merger is not a vehicle for cutting jobs or closing centers.
So the majority of people in the organization will not experience change. There are no health centers currently slated for closing at all. And in fact, I'm not at liberty to share now, but there are several locations that we have already identified for being in need of additional health centers. We are looking at ways to expand telehealth opportunities, right? We're trying to meet patients where they are. And, you know, 92% of millennials, regardless of socioeconomic status, have a smartphone. They live their life on a smartphone. And we need to find better ways to meet them there and give them that high-quality experience that they come to depend upon in a Planned Parenthood center. They should be able to get that through telehealth and online as well. So no, this is not about coming together to cut centers or to cut jobs.
She says New York's Planned Parenthoods are supporting affiliates in states with recently passed abortion bans.
It would be unrealistic, despite this fantastic merger opportunity that we have here in New York State, not to address what's going on across the country. Alabama, Georgia, Ohio, Missouri, Kentucky, we are watching this play out, and we're watching people take advantage of their current legislative structure in order to try to generate a case that they think will be the one that will restrict access to abortion at the federal level. And what are we doing? We're coming together as a federation because, you know, many of us face those situations, and then many of us are in states like New York where we have an obligation to provide all the support that we can because we have such strong support for sexual and reproductive health services here. And so what that looks like in the immediate term is we stand in partnership with them in raising our voices for the incredible threat that patients find themselves under across the state. And then we talk about preparing for the future, right? So we prepare for the future and hope it never comes, but we have an obligation to figure out how patients in states where sexual and reproductive health care will be limited can get to states where it is invested in, it is believed in. And so some of the reasons around the merger as well is with the understanding that we may be facing not only serving more New Yorkers, but also serving patients from outside of New York. And we are very focused on that, both for ourselves in New York and in working in partnership with our sister affiliates who are under incredible stress right now.
McQuaid has noticed an uptick in anti-abortion efforts.
It was a very important year for New York this year, right? We passed the Reproductive Health Act in January. We passed the Comprehensive Contraceptive Coverage Act in January. Pieces of legislation, frankly, that we waited decades to pass. And as a result of that, I think that we are seeing people elevate their voices more loudly than we have previously. But I think that, again, we are standing strong. We commend the governor. We commend the Assembly and the Senate for their members standing strong for what is right for New Yorkers. But I think that we would be foolish to say that there has not been an uptick since the Reproductive Health Act was passed in January. We see it in front of our health centers. We see it in the media.
McQuaid is looking for action on another item.
I think one of the real fundamental pieces in New York and across the country that is missing is comprehensive sexuality education. We need to start with education and information, empowering people to understand their bodies, to understand what healthcare is available to them, and also to start to combat issues of their own identity and people coming for them, not just for their sexual behavior, but for who they are as people, whether that's their gender, their race, their sexual identity, their gender identity, and really embedding that education from young ages in our school systems. Again, it's not about, it's age appropriate for younger folks, and then getting ready for what's happening to their bodies and really understanding what's right and what they're owed. And I think that that's something that we will continue to push for is comprehensive K-12 sexuality education in the state of New York. We have almost no requirements. I mean, there are some requirements. They're, let's just say, not doing quite enough to ensure that people have the access to information they need and deserve.
Before McQuaid became president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of New York City in 2017, she served as president and CEO of Planned Parenthood Great Plains, based in Overland Park, Kansas. She says there have been and continue to be efforts to merge various Planned Parenthoods across the country.
There are Planned Parenthoods that have been merging. I led my former affiliate through two mergers in 2016. I think that they've announced mergers in earlier this year, late last year, in the middle of the country, where Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota formed a strategic alliance with Iowa and Nebraska. There's been a strategic alliance between Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest with Planned Parenthood of Indiana and Kentucky. So finding ways to strengthen our delivery model is going on across the Federation.
Laura McQuaid is president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of New York City, which is planning to merge with four affiliates in New York. She will then assume leadership of the new entity, Planned Parenthood of Greater New York. If the merger is approved, it would launch in early 2020. Jessica Yellen is the former chief White House correspondent for CNN and an Emmy and Gracie Award-winning political journalist for CNN, ABC News, and MSNBC. And now, Yellen takes pen to paper with her new book, Savage News, a searing and at times humorous depiction of contemporary politics and the media that reports on it. In the novel, we meet Natalie, along with her scrappy production team, who has to navigate ratings wars, workplace sexual harassment, and an international political crisis to prove herself. But the closer she gets to stepping into her dream job, the more she wonders if it is worth all the compromise. 51%'s Joe Donahue asked Jessica Yellen how long the book was in her.
Oh my gosh. I mean, that's an excellent question. I was in the news on TV for 15 years, and then it took me 3+ years to actually write the book once I left. So, a long time.
When you set out, was there something you wanted to say? Just in the brief pitch of what it is that you wanted to say about the business you had just come from.
You know, it's about a young woman reporter who always wanted to cover the White House, and she gets the opportunity just as a first lady disappears. So she set out to cover, she's assigned to cover this, what seems to be a sex scandal. And she's set up in a competition with another reporter who first got famous through reality TV, and they decide whoever gets the highest ratings wins. So all of that is a bit about the absurdities of news, the adventure of it, the nature of the silly stories we sometimes have to cover. But if you ask me what is the real larger message, this is a book about a woman finding her voice at work. So many books I read as a kid were about women finding their voice in a relationship or in their family, and women also work. So I really wanted to depict that journey.
At what point in your career did you realize, and this obviously is something very conscious of that you had found your voice in your work?
My gosh, I think I'm still working on it.
Really?
You find it in different stories. Sometimes you're on a story and you're in real flow and you realize, like, this is, I got this. And that's a great feeling. One time, you know, when I was working my way up through local news, I worked in the Tampa market and I was assigned to cover politics. And I was in Tallahassee, Florida in the year 2000. And as you remember, that was the year the presidential recount happened. And I was this young local news reporter covering the recount when all these famous news people showed up in town, all the people I'd been watching, anchors and major political reporters. And I was shoulder to shoulder with them covering that story. And I realized I got it. I was holding my own next to them. I was reporting for local news, but I could do this. And that really gave me the confidence to think I could keep going up the ladder.
You write in the novel about, as I mentioned, the main character, Natalie, endures some very frank criticism about her appearance from her bosses. I assume that you had experienced similar things. And ultimately, what does that do in as far as helping a woman at work find their voice?
So one of the things that happens to Natalie is her first day at the White House, she's called on the carpet by her boss, the bureau chief, because her hair didn't look right. And something similar to that happened to me when I first started covering the White House. And she's constantly told, like, how she should look and appear. And it's just part of the reality of, you know, TV's a visual medium. You got to appear the way you're expected to. I mean, you might not have noticed this before, but pay attention to the news. Isn't it interesting that every single woman on the news seems to have straight hair, but not in real life? Like,
right.
That's the convention of news. So a lot of that just means you have to just comply with these things all the time. There are other just hurdles you have to mount every day to make sure your hair is straight and perfect, your lashes are on and perfect before you break that story, and make sure you get your facts straight while you're doing it.
You could have written a memoir, I suppose, but you chose fiction.
You know, I thought you could have more fun with fiction, and you can do things in fiction you can't do in a memoir. It's a little, and it brings more people in. For me, it does. I wanted to reach people who have no access to the news world, and to bring them on the other side of the camera lens. And I thought this would be a good way to do it. As a kid, I also always wanted to write a novel. I thought I'd be a novelist. So it was a way to realize that dream.
In writing the novel, but you don't go, you know, write what you know is what they say, and you certainly did that. Mm-hmm. So you went to this to your profession and took a good long hard look at it. What do you miss about the day-to-day of being a news correspondent?
I miss the camaraderie of the newsroom. how exciting it, how fun it is to be with a news crew that you love, where everybody's good at a different thing and together you kind of make magic together. I miss just the banter and being in the know. That's always so exciting. When you're one of the first people to know the thing that's going on and you're all trading information, that's great. And just having access to these amazing policy minds who are in Washington who can explain to you why they're making the decisions they're making, that was always exciting covering past White Houses for me. I really enjoyed that part of the job.
All right. What don't you miss?
I see what you're doing there. Got it. You know, the pace. Having three or four BlackBerries or iPhones at once, having to rush on air and be live all the time instead of taking time to really think about the story and, you know, nail it down the way it feels right to you. Those sorts of things. I don't miss the hair and fake eyelashes. Now I can put them on when I'm going out only. And, you know, just sort of the nonstop nature of it. I think it's decidedly worse now than when I was there. In the new reality, the pace and the intensity is off the charts. And it's you know, it's hard. They're working so hard, my former colleagues. I really admire what they're doing.
You were a correspondent during the Obama administration, and by all accounts, that was a very different beat than it is now.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I mean, there's still some... There's still some things that are similar. Like in terms of the media, there's a scene in the book where the bureau chief freaks out because the breaking news banner has crashed. And they're on TV, but they're not able to summon the words breaking news. And so what are we going to do? And after that, they decree that henceforth all news out of Washington is breaking unless deemed otherwise. So that was a funny, you know,
right.
A send up of how things were. And it's kind of even more true now. In terms of the White House, the biggest difference is sometimes we'd have a tense relationship with the Obama White House and with the Bush White House, but it was based on respect. And in the current moment, the White House is working hard to delegitimize the press and to discredit fact-based reporting in many cases. And that's not just challenging. I think it's dangerous. And I think that journalists are rising to the occasion, but it's a very challenging reality.
When you were writing this, is it weird not to have a looming deadline of 10 minutes from now?
Oh, my God. You have no idea. I mean, it took me 3.5 years to write.
Yeah.
Because I just had never – the beauty of a deadline is it forces you to finish. And then you're done for the day. Like, it doesn't hang over you. You know, unless you're in an ongoing story. But then even then, it releases the pressure a bit. With a novel, it sits on your shoulder. It lives inside you all the time. You're always trying to work through things. And I'll tell you, at first, you know, a TV news story is roughly 1 minute, 45 seconds or shorter read out loud. When I first sat down to write the novel, every story I wrote came out to about 1 minute, 45 seconds if read out loud.
Yeah.
I had to break myself of that.
And in the actual writing, do you think being a journalist makes you and helps in writing fiction?
No, I actually think it makes it really hard.
Really?
The part that was easy for me was when she was solving the story. I'm not going to give anything away if I say that she's chasing one story but discovers another. And then when she's solving the story, that moved for me because I know how to think about how you do with that piece. Right? Like that was just natural. And then some scenes were natural for me to depict. But what you have as a journalist is you know the beginning, middle, and end before you start. You have like, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. You have a closed set of pieces, and it's just a question of how you put them together. In a novel, it's this infinity of choice. It's the tyranny of choice. Anything can happen. And so I had to learn how to make decisions and then learn the craft, the arc of a novel. And I was only able to do that when I found some great editors.
And the obviously the editors help in that process. So what's next for you?
I am now reporting the news on Instagram. I have an Instagram feed. It's at my name, at Jessica Yellen, Yellin. I frame it as news, not noise. And what I do is I kind of isolate what are the most important stories happening right now, and I explain them in clear language without giving you a panic attack. The idea is, I think so much of the news, there's so much jargon. Every molehill is made into a mountain, and everything's designed to be outrage-based. And I think we need a break from that, a little bit of a release. And I'm trying to help another audience find news and stay calm.
That was former chief White House correspondent for CNN, Jessica Yellen, speaking with 51%'s Joe Donahue. Yellen's new book is Savage News. When health researchers make headlines, it's often for a sensational project, like manipulating genes to create a baby. But others are examining broader issues, including how and where you live affects your health. Jill Sheridan of Side Effects Public Media reports on a project to help understand how all the pieces of the health puzzle fit together.
That health puzzle covers your habits, culture, social life, and much more. And it helps determine whether you get serious illnesses like cancer, diabetes, or a heart attack.
The social environment can either turn on protective genes or it can turn off protective genes. And so social factors like loneliness, social factors like childhood traumas, these things have been scientifically shown to affect whether or not they're going to get certain kinds of diseases.
That's Indiana University professor Bernice Pesca-Solito, who leads the person-to-person health interview study. She says it explores the next level of a person's health makeup.
We really need that interaction for this next phase of science, which looks at them as a whole person, not just the disease in the body and the bed.
And that's why field interviewer Paula Williamson has come to a northern suburb of Indianapolis.
We are in a neighborhood of modular homes in Noblesville.
Williamson gets out of her big black pickup. She's been knocking on doors for the past few months, asking people about a lot of things related to the study. Family history, lifestyle, mental health, drug use, child experiences, financial stability, and their community. She also asks for DNA samples. The genetic material will be analyzed and calculated with the survey research. Williamson says people have been very open.
There's part ownership in this project that people want their voices to be heard.
On another day, Williamson is on the south side of Indianapolis at the apartment of Sandra Jo Edwards. When Edwards received an invitation to participate in the study, she threw it away.
I just thought it was just something, you know, that come from, you know, wherever. And I was like, no, I'm not going to do this.
But when Williamson rang her doorbell, she started thinking about her parents and her family health. Both of Edwards' parents had cancer. Her mother is a survivor. Her father passed away.
You know, my father, I mean, he just did it himself, though. You know, he didn't want to go do the treatments or anything like that.
Her information will be compiled with thousands of others to give a clear, deeper look at why one person develops a health condition and another does not. This type of research is growing, says Dr. Georges Benjamin, executive director of the American Public Health Association.
And if you think about that, it makes a lot of sense because where you live determines access to schools, jobs, access to food sources, a range of social activities, whether you have walkable, bikeable communities with parks, playgrounds.
He says if you ask what people need for healthy lives, you might be surprised by their answer.
Our priority right now is figuring out how we can get a bus stop in our community so that we can get on the bus and we can go to work. And you can't engage that community until you fix that transportation problem.
Professor Pesca-Solito says solutions that follow the Indiana study will take the whole person into account.
Because even if you come up with the most brilliant prevention strategies, if the people who you're targeting don't want it, don't like the way you're doing it, it's going to be useless.
This type of study focuses on what researchers call the social determinants of health. And Benjamin says it has an even broader impact. Just like healthy behaviors are a personal responsibility.
When we talk about the social determinants, we're talking about that community responsibility to help our neighbors and ourselves be more healthy.
The person-to-person study is part of a larger Indiana University initiative with ambitious goals. By the year 2020, it aims to cure at least one cancer, one childhood disease, and find a preventative solution to a chronic illness. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Jill Sheridan.
With Father's Day this month, here's a little something about dads in the bird world and what roles the moms play.
This is Bird Note. It's Father's Day, so let's take a look at avian fatherhood. After his initial involvement, the male hummingbird has nothing more to do with the family. In fact, the female may move away from his territory because he can be so aggressive. Then there's the peregrine falcon father, which shares family duties almost equally with the mother. He helps incubate the eggs, and after the young hatch, he brings food for the entire family for 3 weeks. When the young peregrines fledge, Dad is right there with Mom, coaxing them to fly and teaching them to hunt on the wing. But the emu of Australia, that's the drum-like sound you're hearing. Now there's a father. The male emu makes the nest. The female lays her eggs, but then abandons the male to begin again elsewhere. The male remains on the eggs for nearly 2 months, eating and drinking almost nothing, never leaving the nest for any reason. And the father may stay with the young emus for up to 2 years. Bird Note wishes a happy day to all the fathers out there, feathered and otherwise. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1559.